It's a repeat performance of the Bob McCowan podcast. Yours truly, along with John Shannon.
We call it the best of Bob.
Well, that's a relative term.
Hey, if you're not saying it, who is?
Well, that's my point, I think.
Yeah.
Some perspective from south of the 49th. We don't really focus on Canada more than the United States or any place else around the world, but every once in a while we get somebody with a traditional U.S. view. All three of them are U.S. residents. I don't know if Abel's a U.S. citizen or not, is he?
Yes, he is. Born in Brooklyn.
We'll talk to Alan Abel, Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, and Keith Olbermann, who has had more jobs at more stations than you can count. But all of them are intriguing, and all of them have big opinions. Abel, Ryan, Olbermann, this time on the Bob McCowan podcast. Well, Shannon, we had so much fun when Alan Abel, the former outstanding columnist with the Globe and Mail, was with us a few weeks ago. We decided to invite him back. There's no better storyteller, and I assume we'll spend the entire program listening to Abel tell us stories about various things.
Well, nobody loves the history of sports and loves politics better. And is there a better combination than sports and politics?
I don't know of one.
No, it's fantastic.
Less of us and more of him. Alan Abel joins us after these messages. Yours truly, Bob McCowan, with John Shannon over there. And our friend Alan Abel rejoins us and is, for those of you not watching this episode, Abel apparently felt underdressed the last time he was on, so he got all dolled up here on a Monday while Shannon and I are in our backyard work clothes.
You're very, because
my daughter has pajama day today.
You're very intimidating, Bob. You know, you scare the heck out of people. So
I have no recollection of what I wore the last time you were on, Abel.
But you might have worn a sports coat.
I did.
Oh, you didn't wear a three-piece suit. He does it.
He did.
Well, he does own one, but it was from 1978. So the flare collars
I can see the Goodwill label on it.
Yeah. Flare collars and cuffs on the pants.
Well, what's wrong with you two? Like you don't think a suit should last 50 years?
Okay, Mr. Travolta.
At the very least, it should come back into style. There are only so many styles.
I bet Trump has had lawsuits that lasted 50 years.
Well, he may be about to get into one.
See, we haven't brought his name up for at least 4 weeks on this show. At least 4 weeks.
I saw him almost every day for 4 years.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Well, not to jump on that bandwagon, but does this guy wind up a free man the rest of his life, or do you think he's going to prison at some point?
Oh, stop.
Do I think he's going to prison? That's probably unlikely. Do I think he's in for some messy times in the Southern District of New York State? Probably. Yeah. If it's in the political interest of those prosecutors to do that. And it probably is, especially if any of his family decide to get into New York State politics.
Well, and especially
if he go to prison? No, I think if Ford pardoned Nixon, I think at some point Kamala Harris or Lara Trump or whoever the next president is in a few years pardons Donald Trump, I think. But that's
really? Wow.
Yeah, I think the precedent was set by Gerald Ford when he gave Nixon a blanket pardon, though Nixon hadn't been charged with any crimes at all.
That's right.
And said, this guy's not. I don't think the spectacle of Trump behind bars is a necessary one in his late 70s.
I don't disagree with that necessarily.
He even pardoned Kushner's father.
Well, you said if it's in the political interest of the, especially the people in New York and around New York City, and you would know that that is a very Democratic region.
Well, the state of Georgia is supposedly investigating his conduct in appealing for election fraud there, or whatever he told the governor there. Kemp, just find me the votes, which is sort of a Richard Daley, Joe Kennedy kind of conversation. But no reason to think that the people in Georgia, the state legislature in Georgia, want to see Trump in prison. But that's a discussion for another day.
Well, perhaps. The only thing I will say is that the majority of the ruling parties traditionally and currently in Georgia are Republicans. And I don't know how that will play into the...
Well, they just elected two Democratic senators.
Well, I get that. But the governor's a, the governor's a Republican. And whether
and the court system, I would think. I'm no expert on the Georgia state judiciary, but I would think that's mostly Republican appointees.
Well, it's been a Republican stronghold for decades.
Okay, enough of Face the Nation here. Here we go. Come on.
You went to Yankee Stadium for the opening series against
last,
the
last Sunday.
Blue Jays, yeah.
And I was with a fellow who'd never been up there. And he wanted to make a pilgrimage, so he went to Monument Park and looked around the place. And it's the place I started going to. My first game there was 1958, but of course that's not the there that's there.
No, it's just next door.
It's a mock-up of it, but it's effective, and the monuments are still there, though. I think they've cheapened Monument Park. I think you're equating their Babe Ruth with Tino Martinez or vice versa. And Paul O'Neill, and are these legends worthy of Garrick Ruth and DiMaggio? But it sells, and it's...
That's an interesting question, because generations measure legends. Those of us that are a little older, you know, because we remember back, this is like the famous line about when Kennedy was shot, and somebody turns and says, Ted Kennedy was shot? You know, it's all relative to the generation you live in. So for Paul O'Neill and Edgar Martinez were great Yankees to a guy that's 27 or 34.
Yeah, you didn't see Ruth play. You never saw Garrick.
No, I know. That's
first,
right.
The first three monuments were Ruth, Garrick, and Miller Huggins. Who knows Miller Huggins? You know the biggest plaque there is Steinbrenner?
Is it really?
I'm shocked.
Yeah. With language that would come... I mean, it's not a mystery that Trump envied or was an acolyte of Steinbrenner, that he wished he had owned the Yankees. But it's like this, a great humanitarian, great sportsman, obviously penned by George himself, and a plaque twice the size of even Pope John the 23rd. So he owned the building. He could put whatever he wanted on it. And there's even a permanent picture of Steinbrenner on the scoreboard that never goes away. The boss with his picture on it.
On the video board?
Yeah. If you own the place, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Well, so we went, but the interesting thing was watching how they scatter. They listed a crowd of 11,000. There couldn't have been more than 4,000 or 5,000 people in the ballpark. And it's strange to look around and see 8 people in section 422 and 8 people in section 309 and 12 people. I think there were 7 people in our section. And so you have the mask police, the ushers, because it was so early in the season that they were probably still expecting that the supervisors were looking at them, watching them. So they had a little sign they held up. One side was a picture of a face with a mask on it, and the other side said, please. But if you were eating, you don't have to wear a mask. So if you had a bag of peanuts, you could stretch that out for 9 innings. And of course, to get in, you show either a vaccination card or you got COVID tested within a few hours before at a walk-in clinic. So theoretically, nobody in the ballpark is contagious anyway, but they still were enforcing the masks. Some of the concessions were open, some were closed. Sort of a strange experience, but not that strange if you went to early season ball games when there often were only 10,000 people in the center. Just that they were so spread out. It wasn't everybody got down close. I would imagine in a few weeks, once the ushers aren't afraid of being written up, that you'll be able to slip a guy at 10 or 20 and get to a better seat. But it was an interesting experience because otherwise it was just a ballgame.
You used the phrase, Abel, you didn't have to wear your mask when you were eating. Can you please explain to me how you would wear your mask when you were eating?
You could slip food underneath it, I guess, somehow. One peanut at a time. It'd be more difficult with a hot dog.
You can't. That's not an option.
Insert the food into your mouth and then replace the mask for the exhalations.
I'm wondering when would have been the last time the New York Yankees played in front of 4,000 people at home. And you might have to go back to the early 70s when Steinbrenner bought the team from CBS. I think it was 73 George bought the team. And at that point, the Yankees were a miserable lot, and New York basically paid no attention to them.
Well, their last pennant in that run was 64. And I think by 66, they finished last.
Right. Yeah.
I believe. And I used to go whenever the Senators were in town, because I was on the Washington Senators in Little League. So we'd go to the stadium to see the Nats, as they were called. Oh, I see. And they were then, there would be nobody there. Unless it was a giveaway or a Sunday doubleheader.
See, now you...
The afternoon, Kansas City A's, Washington Senators. They might only have drawn 5,000 or 6,000.
Yeah. See, now you, Alan, you've opened the door, because we're going to hear for the 10 millionth time the fact that you played for the Senators as a boy, and little Bobby played for the Dodgers, and wore the Dodgers, and the Dodgers, and he became a Dodger fan, and they were yellow. It wasn't blue. It was yellow. You know what I mean? We're going to hear that story again.
Well, but you see, Abel is doing nothing more than justifying, you know, because I get asked. You know, you didn't get asked. You just explained your relationship to the Senators. And it's the exact same reason why I became a Dodger fan. I was...
No. Why was it, Bob? Tell me why.
Because my first baseball team was the Dodgers. I had no idea who they were. I was 6 years old. And that very fall, they moved to Los Angeles.
It's like being indoctrinated into the Proud Boys. There's no difference.
I imagine that identical.
This is online. That was on the field. 2 years in left field in Little League. Never had a ball hit to me. So the last game went right through my legs.
Did it really? Well, did they give you the error or?
I knew the score. I don't think I ever hit the ball either. I seem to recall everyone either walked or struck out.
You got the participation trophy though. Alan Abel second.
1959, you didn't.
Yeah, that's another edition of the 70s and 80s. That's right, the participation award.
So I have not been to, I guess, can you still call it the new Yankee Stadium? I guess you can.
No, there's only one Yankee Stadium.
Well, no, but I mean, there was one that was renovated many times, and then they built a new one.
It's gone. It's gone, Bob.
Well, I haven't been to the one that's there now. I went to the old one. Compare the two, because you have been to both numerous times.
Well, one is Yankee Stadium, one isn't. That's the
So what's there now is some imposter.
No, it's not an imposter. It's just a different edifice, but it has the monuments.
Yeah.
And it has the molding along the top. Obviously not the same, but it's just a modern 21st century stadium with 21st century beer prices.
Hold on. The monuments aren't in the field of play anymore, though.
No.
I mean, that was always the amazing thing.
That's when center field was 461 to center field.
That's right. I mean, that was always the amazing thing, is I remember watching footage in the 60s of the ball going between the monuments and whoever was in center field, whether it was Mantle or the visiting team, having to go and try to dodge it and find the baseball. It was like,
doubt that happened very often.
It was like street ball.
Well, the Polo Grounds had a monument too to Eddie Grant, who had been a former Giant player who was killed in World War I. There was a monument there. Mays's famous catch, he's to the right field side of the monument. But I think Polo Grounds was 455 or even, maybe even longer than that.
So did
461, you could put a herd of cattle out there. No one's going to hit the ball out there anyway.
So Alan, you were at the original Yankee Stadium, Ebbets Field?
Ebbets Field once when I was 7. All I remember is Emmett Kelly the Clown.
No kidding. Oh, he was there, was he?
Yeah.
It was their last weekend.
Oh. So Ebbets Field and then the Polo Grounds. Which one did
you? Polo Grounds many times when the Mets were there.
Oh, okay. So, these places are iconic for a New York baseball fan, but they really weren't that big. Were they? I mean, they were under 35,000 seats. The Yankee Stadium was.
Ebbets Field was under 35,000. The Polo Grounds was more built almost for football.
Right.
It was a horseshoe. And that would have probably fit 55 or 6. And Yankee Stadium had crowds over 60,000.
No, Yankee Stadium, I know, but I didn't realize the Polo Grounds was that big. I thought it was a smaller stadium as well.
Was it built for the Giants?
It was built in 1911 and almost The previous stadium had burnt down. There was a stadium called the Polo Grounds. It burnt down. I think it caught fire on opening day in 1911. And they rebuilt it as a one of the new steel and concrete horseshoes.
Mm.
That had started, I think, with Shibe Park in Philadelphia.
There, you know, there's often talk, Trump used to talk about, he had a plan to build the stadium on the waterfront, didn't he?
On the west side of Manhattan.
Yeah.
In Hudson Yards. Well, there's a Trump city there now. He owned massive amounts of real estate north of the Lincoln Tunnel along the Hudson River.
I mean, the Giants are still playing in New Jersey. Is there a sense that there'll ever be another football stadium in anywhere in the city?
Why?
I wouldn't think that would be the most productive source of revenue per square foot.
Yeah.
The building, how many times a year is that stadium used? 8 home games. Well, that'll be maybe 9 home games, a couple of exhibition games. That's a lot.
Well, I mean, let's face it. They were smart enough for the football teams at least to play together, right? I mean, the double home made so much more sense than having one team play at one stadium on one side of the city and one play on the other.
And still, it's only used 25 times a year.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of college football teams.
Not to dwell on New York sports, but a sort of a revitalization of the New York Knicks. I mean, not to the point where anybody thinks they're a championship team, but at least they're respectable. And it has been, my God, a long time since they were respectable. Knicks basketball was a big, big, big thing. I really think it is still. I'm not interested in what you think.
Well, how far back do you want to go? Because when I was a kid, it was nothing. When I was a kid, they played NBA doubleheaders.
Yeah, but that was the whole league.
The Knicks would play the second game.
First game
will be Rochester and Philadelphia, the Warriors and the Royals. Second game will be this Syracuse and the Knicks.
Yeah.
Sometimes the first game was the Globetrotters. We go for doubleheaders. But compared to college basketball, the NBA was far distant second in New York.
Well, we also understand that, you know, when Larry O'Brien was the commissioner of the NBA in the late 70s, this league was perilously close to folding.
Days.
Yeah, they were on the cusp. And it's historically significant to suggest, and I don't know whether you would agree, Abel, that the arrival of Magic and Bird essentially saved that league. You agree?
I mean, they were dying even after Willis Reed and the Knicks in 70. New York itself didn't save the league.
No, apparently they did not.
I think when you look at what went on in professional basketball through the 70s when we were children,
children. I was married.
Yeah, but you were still a child, Alan. That's what she told you many times. The competing league really threw them into a flux because
I covered the ABA. It was fun.
The ABA played more fun basketball.
Pistol Pete and Dr. J
and the 3-point line
and the red, white, and blue ball.
I mean, that's the one. I actually missed that ball.
You do not?
No, I do, because on television you could see it better. That was the days of black and white television. You know, for most people, color was you could get color TV, but a lot of people still watched them in black and white. You could see the ball better, which reminds me of something else. The National Football League has gone to a darker football. Have you noticed that, Abel?
No, because my cataracts would prevent me from noticing the difference.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. There is a procedure that you can get done that can assist with that in your advance.
I had it done last year.
How's
your vision now?
I had it done by the guy who wrote the textbook, Johns Hopkins, the leading eye surgeon in the world.
Of course you did. Why would you go to some guy on a street corner, right? When you got connections.
And I said to him, have you ever done this before? And he said, you'll be the fourth. First three didn't go well. I said, we've got a weekend. Could you at least read the textbook? And he came in for the surgery on Monday. He said, I didn't have time to read the textbook. But I watched a video. You should be fine. And one goes from nearsighted to farsighted in a few minutes. And that is
true. Yeah.
That is extraordinarily unsettling.
Did you have to trade in your glasses for another pair?
Yeah.
You really did, huh?
From nearsighted, from taking glasses off to read, but wearing them driving, to not wearing them driving and putting them on to read. And that's in a flash. It only takes 10 minutes.
The procedure only takes 10 minutes?
Yeah, that's all.
So listen. So we've been We're talking for about 20 minutes, and we talked Donald Trump and cataracts. This is great. This is really good.
Well, go ahead, take the.
Oh, something for younger viewers.
what is it? As a fair warning, or what?
All right, let's discuss Pokemon then. Go ahead, John. Jump in.
You must know more about Pokemon than I do, Bob.
I know nothing about it.
I get a phone call every 6 weeks from my son. Dad, did we really throw the Pokemon cards out? They're worth something today.
Everything is allegedly worth something today.
Yeah.
Except the stuff I've got.
I just put all my stuff up for auction, going up for auction in June.
Now, what?
Mostly programs.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly programs, press pins, things like that. A couple of what I'm told are rarities, a Negro League scorecard with a lot of autographs on it. Hall of Famers, but no one knows what something is worth. It's worth what, I like to say, it's worth what one person will spend to prevent the other guy from getting it.
That's
the truth in that.
That's in the Lipsy Spartz and Steiner economics textbook, supply and demand.
I was supply never a demand. Collector. I always thought, and I think most of my peers thought, that you're sitting with Gretzky in the dressing room or Yogi Berra in the dressing room. You didn't finish your interview and then ask him to sign stuff. I knew only one writer who did and amassed a tremendous collection. But the rest of us, we thought, well, professionals don't do that.
Yeah.
And obviously spent lots of time with all the great sport, not just I, but all of us, sports journalists of that era. Spent a lot of time with Ali and Gretzky and Reggie Jackson. Never thought of saying, would you sign this? And in hindsight, I'm not ashamed that I followed that, but it would have had a lot of stuff worth a lot more money.
So if you and Bob could fill a week of you two talking about Muhammad Ali. So let's remove Ali from the conversation.
Who, I was talking about his brother, Rahman Ali. Yeah.
Who? Thank you, Alan. By the way, Alan's going to be in Atlantic City for 2 weeks starting Thursday.
Yeah,
so
by the veal.
Who
Trump Taj Mahal.
Who other than Ali made an impact on you from the point of view of, I wouldn't mind going back and talking to this guy more, or he made an impact, he made you think more. Is there somebody that jumps out?
I think the somebodies are people who you wouldn't even know if I said their names. Boxers who didn't go very far. I think the whole enterprise is probably very different now. I never wrote about money, contracts, salary caps, didn't write about drugs and suspension and all that. Tried to write about personalities.
Right.
And the most memorable personalities weren't necessarily the guy who was leading the league in goals or scoring or batting. But the fact that they had, baseball players especially, seemed so ordinary physically and had made it to that level, that they were just perplexing to me, because we all loved baseball. We all spent every minute playing baseball that we could. I remember talking to Rick Cerrone. Rick Cerrone was a catcher for the Blue Jays, later for the Yankees. And he'd grown up, I think, in Newark, somewhere across the river in Jersey. And I remember asking him, were you at this certain, there was a famous doubleheader in 1961, the 4th of July, when the Tigers were almost leading the Yankees in the pennant race, and there were 61,000 people. Were you at that game? Were you at Jim Bunning's perfect game at Shea Stadium? Were you at the 23-inning game at Shea? Were you at the game when Mays came back? And he said, I'm going to go to those games. I was playing baseball. And that's why I'm in the major leagues, and you're writing about it.
Oh, interesting.
What we tried to do was, what these people did was completely public. Completely public enterprise. Go out in the ball. Get everyone can see see you playing. And we tried to find the personal within the public or the private within the public, and probably always failed, almost always failed. I remember going to see Lloyd Mosby in California after he retired, and he and I were always friendly. I wouldn't say we were friends, but we were friendly and we talked. And I remember saying to him, did I get it? Did I come even close to getting it right? Did I have any sense of what it was like to be doing what you guys did? And he said, you came closer than most of them, but no, you never knew. Nobody knew. Nobody knew whose mom was sick. Nobody knew who's had a fight with their wife that morning. Nobody knew. You knew what happened on the field. You didn't know it. It's impossible to know. I guess in a way it should be impossible.
Yeah.
But it was our job, our enterprise, was to try to make public what the fans in the stands couldn't see. And the people who let you do that, people who let you in, weren't always the superstars.
From a safe environment now, I understand. The city of New York is close to immune from any problems, any COVID problems.
Yeah.
Not on that point, huh?
What are you talking about? They still have Jim Dolan?
That's one problem. Yeah, thanks for getting me started on that before I even say hello, John. Yes, we still have that viral epidemic that's been raging here for the entirety of the 21st century. Now that he's extended himself to burning down a hockey team. You know, it's more fun than ever, but in terms of overall health, yeah, I mean, it really is. It's now a surprise to see somebody wearing a mask out of doors. I would say on the streets in the last week, it's particularly, it's 6%, 6% out of people, very few. Mm-hmm. And I have, the best restaurant in New York has reopened. After 2 years, they had been closed because of a building destruction, and they've reopened near me, within steps from my front door. And they are, I have eaten there inside, no mask, nobody wearing a mask, no fear of it, 10 times out of the last 12 nights. So I'll be 500 pounds by Christmas, but we'll be healthy otherwise.
Variety is the spice of life, except if you're Keith Olbermann, I suppose, huh?
Well, maybe the menu's big. Big and varied, you know?
There's an entire menu, and I have like six favorite dishes. So, you know, do you have to have something different every night for 2 weeks? I mean, I don't think so.
Well, I don't know. At my house, I go from a Big Mac to a quarter pounder to a McChicken. And, you know, that's three days and three different meals, right?
Yes. Well, this is a butternut squash ravioli in a sage butter sauce. And when you have one, you go, let's see, for dessert, how would it look if I ordered the same thing? And then the guy goes, well, you know, in the old place opposite the Jazz Center, we used to have a jazz performer who'd order it three servings at a time.
No.
and then get a fourth to go. And I was like, well, the fourth to go is excessive, but I can see the rest of it. So, yeah.
So, Olbermann, this is not like some coffee houses where you get a card, and if you get it stamped 10 times, you get a free meal or anything. That's not what we're talking about, is it?
No, but, you know, it's close enough that there have been historically in the restaurants in the area, there are a lot of them, there's a discount for residents of, you know, sort of a small group of buildings that are connected. So, you know, I started, the owner is an old friend of mine because I frequented his old place, although it was blocks away from where I lived and often quite a commute from where I lived, depending on where I lived. And it's, you know, he's talking about giving a 20% discount. And I'm going, well, let's up that 500 to Halloween, 500 pounds at Halloween. If you're going to have a discount of 20%, I could go there, let's say three meals a day. And then, next night you're going to see is me like this. I'm like, hi, Bob. Hi, John. Yeah. So one health problem gets replaced by another. That's the story of aging.
So before you came on, John and I were chatting about the Stanley Cup final, and it just appears to be an inevitability that this Tampa team is going to wind up winning this thing.
Well, one would think so, unless you're the 42 Red Wings, right? And then that's,
well, yeah.
That's it. I mean, I didn't see either of Montreal's head coaches throw a punch and get suspended for a couple of games, throw a punch at a referee and then come back. So I don't know that brilliant burst of energy is going to hit them, although they played okay last night.
I don't root for either of these teams. I tend not to root for any team. But I found myself, or I find myself in these kinds of situations. I'm intrigued by how you guys react. Late in the game, you know, it's 2-2, and Montreal gets that penalty with a minute or so left, and it's a double minor. So even if they go into overtime, it's going to be 2.5-3 minutes of power play. And I actually was rooting for Tampa. And the reason I was rooting for Tampa was I love dynasties. I've said many times before, dynasties, the older you get, as you think back over the dozens, even hundreds of seasons that the three of us have watched, covered, what do you remember? Well, you remember greatness. You remember great individuals, and you remember great teams and dynasties. You don't remember the one-offs. You know, I mean, there's the odd event that comes here and there, but that's the thing that sticks with you your entire life. And this Tampa team is really kind of close to being a dynastic team, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I don't know what my aversion is to them. I know a lot of people think fondly of the coach. I always thought that his press conferences were less than sportsmanlike. I think that may be a polite way to phrase it. And there's something inherently, something doesn't sit right with me that the hockey center of the United States is in one of the last places I would still willingly associate with hockey in a community that is not particularly interesting. And for all of the greatness of that team, and I'm not saying, well, I don't like them, therefore they're no good, but I have a hard time coming up with a rooting interest for any one of the players on that team. And you know, it used to for a while was known as the Tampa Bay ex-Rangers, so I had a rooting interest for a while. I can't get excited about them, and I don't know why that is. And I'm also, I think this is true. I can't possibly speak for hockey fans in the United States as a whole. We are not one entity, but I would think that most of them outside, and this speaks to the NHL's regionalization within the States. I think most people watching, if asked in the United States, if asked, who do you want to see win, would have been the Canadiens. I think that's a much more popular franchise. I think, and this is sometimes hard to convey, but I think the Canadian franchises, particularly Montreal and Toronto, are much more popular than your run of the mill, you know, sort of nouveau last 35 years American franchise. So I agree with your point, but I'm holding out hope for the Canadiens just on a hockey historian.
No, fair enough. No.
So what, you know, when you look at the TV ratings, if, you know, the NBA semifinals, they're threefold larger than hockey right now, at least. And Phoenix is a top 15 market. Milwaukee certainly isn't. Atlanta is. But where do you put the following of hockey in your country right now?
Well, when I was doing the night I did the highlights on ESPN of my childhood team winning the Stanley Cup in 1994, right, following the play-by-play broadcast, our play-by-play broadcast did not have my first boss, Sam Rosen, but our boys finished ours, and then I came on the SportsCenter and did the 3-minute highlight package. The night that happened, I think it was pretty clear it was football, baseball, NBA, and right behind the NBA was the NHL. And there was a lot of hope among those of us who have found hockey to be a fairly more sophisticated game than baseball, with far more interesting people and far more interesting teams. There was a hope that that leap forward would be advanced, particularly by the coming expansions to the Sun Belt and, you know, the new teams in Southern California and in Florida, and, you know, wherever by then we knew the Hartford Whalers would eventually move. It's like, well, they're going to Nashville. They have a deal they can go to Nashville with. But we thought that was the beginning of it, because
that's 25 years ago, though.
No, I understand that. But I think that's the answer. The answer to the question starts 25 years ago, actually, you know, 27 years ago. Rangers win the Stanley Cup. And what happens immediately when New York, Manhattan, as opposed to Long Island, gets a Stanley Cup, and all the advertising companies are like, well, now it's time to put a little money into hockey. We have a, you know, a New York team. We can get free tickets out of it if we buy the spots on the broadcast. Well, what happens? There's no season right. in the following year. And I, Joe, I always thought that was a missed opportunity and the road not taken, and who knows what would have happened then. But I think over the that period of time, since the Rangers paraded the cup down Broadway, I think hockey has settled into a kind of permanent fourth. And there's no hope of reaching the number three sport, which is, I'm sad to say, baseball, and the number two sport, which is clearly basketball. And I'm not even factoring in the college sports, because it's college sports is such a regional thing that, you know, as big as it is in some parts of the country, it's meaningless. There's no college basketball or football in the Northeast, essentially. So that's that area is gone. But, you know, the thing about all sports in the United States has been, and it's been true gradually, it's been growing and growing, and now we're sort of seeing it accelerate. The sports that manage to make some of their teams at least national entities, identifiable with fan bases everywhere in the country, are the sports in which the postseason sells and draws audiences. And those sports that have failed to do that or have cut back on their national footprint, like baseball, have seen their ratings decline. And the NHL is kind of in the middle, but I mean, you could very easily identify one and 1A in terms of national teams in Canada. I mean, obviously you're going to rank seven of them. You're going to come up with a one and a seven, but one and 1A are miles different from the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And who are the national teams? What hockey fan would make sure he's going to watch the Stanley Cup final with or without his team being present in it? And that's a huge problem for the NHL. And baseball is discovering that's what's killing baseball's ratings, because nobody cares about the World Series anymore, which used to be the World Series, everything stops. And mm-hmm. now who's playing? I don't like either of those teams. I'm going to watch a rerun of Bewitched.
Well, how much of this, though, guys, is...
She's pretty good. She was quite pretty, though, Elizabeth Montgomery.
Lovely woman and a friend of mine and a great storyteller. She was tremendous. She was a big sports fan, too.
A lot of this is relative to the star syndrome and the ability to draw fans, I've always perceived, in a postseason where you don't really have, in most cases, don't have a rooting interest in either team, is who's that great player that I haven't seen very much of, and now I'm going to get to see them multiple times. In the absence of that, where do you go? And has the NBA done the best job of creating stars, creating attractions that have some kind of storyline before the final series begins?
But the sport is more more conducive to creating stars.
Well,
you know, when LeBron can play 44 minutes, I mean, if Sidney Crosby played 44 minutes a night in a 60 minute game, he'd be a star. He'd be a bigger star. But it's not physically possible. Well, it's not physically possible.
And there's the other element to it, which is it. You know, one star can in fact a sport make in this country, and I think. You know, we had epic periods of time in the NBA that preceded Michael Jordan. We had Larry Bird and we had Magic Johnson at perhaps their, you know, at least their relative to age, their athletic top points of their career. And yet it required a Michael Jordan to come in and people then began to see it as Michael Jordan and the NBA. But the other part of it is since then, as you know, those sort of rare matchups that you're talking about, Bob, is like the World Series used to be. You know, mm-hmm. I've never seen Willie Mays play against Mickey Mantle, mm-hmm. except in the All-Star game, then it doesn't really mean anything. And here's, it means everything. Well, that's all gone because of interleague play. You've seen everybody play everybody else. The All-Star game has no meaning in baseball. But the other part of it, about that, your point about the NBA that's so good, is that the second half of it is that the NBA is the game and the number of players on the court and the number of players in the teams are so small that it's not just, I want to see LeBron James. It's, I want to see this new combination in which LeBron James plays alongside this player. And then these two guys get to be teammates and they're going to face, maybe they'll face each other in the finals. If not, and your six leading contenders have two guys who you may have not seen play together before, and you certainly have never seen two guys playing against those particular two guys they're playing in playing against in the finals or anywhere along the lines. And I think that's as much as that sort of sucked out of the regular season and the idea of continuity from year to year, it's exciting because you were seeing stars in new contexts. And that doesn't happen in other sports. Football No. is, I mean, football does periodically show us that, as Brady going to the Buccaneers did. And that provided a level of excitement just when you might go, you know, I've been seeing Tom Brady in the Super Bowl since I was a child. I don't really need to see it again. But now it's interesting because he has a new cast. And you really do begin to think about what the psychological dynamics are of entertainment and new components to it and sports as entertainment and one's willingness to watch a playoff series that one is not personally invested in.
It's a Tuesday. Still Tuesday, John? I think it's still Tuesday.
Still Tuesday all day, Bob.
Okay, good. It's Bob McCown. It's John Shannon on the program. And with us, one of our favorites from the Boston Globe, Bob Ryan, is with us. This is an unusual time for Boston sports fans, Mr. Ryan, who've been spoiled beyond belief for the past decade or so. Their Celtics are gone. The Bruins are on the precipice. I guess the Red Sox are playing okay, but not sure how long that will be sustainable. Let's begin with the situation with the Celtics. The Danny Ainge departure, surprising or was it anticipated?
Let me just say before we address that, with regard to the general situation in Boston, obviously people are spoiled. Obviously, a day of reckoning had to come sooner or later. We have been the most blessed city in all of North America since the 21st century, with 12 parades, 6 other trips to the finals. And I'm not even counting the MLS. We had 3 trips to those finals too. Oh, and a few college national championships. Okay. Now, the Celtics. It was the timing of it all within literally now 12 to 14 hours after the final game, there was a press conference. The word had dribbled out in the morning that Danny was leaving and Brad was taking over. The idea that Danny was leaving was not a total shock, unnecessarily. He had been on the job 18 years. We knew that there was a heart situation. He actually was asked a direct question. The first question at this press conference, is this health related? And almost somewhat surprisingly, I thought, he said yes. He acted in the affirmative. He's had 2 heart attacks, one at age 50, one at age 60. And when he had the second one 2 years ago, his family really was upset. And Danny made an allusion to that the stress of the job, et cetera, they were concerned about him. Okay, Danny leaving, and I don't think he's leaving basketball forever. I think, you know, at the least he'll be a Jerry West-like consultant for somebody down the road. He's only 62. Okay. The other thing though, number one, there was a lot of people circling back and pointing at Brad because of the circumstance of the team being a highly underachieving team, made arguably the most disappointing team in the entire NBA this year, although the book isn't closed on the Clippers yet. But I think the Celtics have qualified. The idea that Brad at age 44 would leave coaching and take this front office job and left unspoken, unasked, and therefore unanswered was the following. Brad, does this mean you're never going to coach again? You're 44 and you claim you love coaching. I can't believe that's the case, that this is a lifer job now as an executive, that at 44, he won't coach at some level again. But that question wasn't asked and wasn't answered. That's the shock that we didn't know. I don't think there's a person in the media anywhere that ever projected Brad in this job this young, at this young age.
Well, that said, Danny Ainge was 44 when he took over the Celtics.
Oh, no, I know that. No, my point is, and that the Brad has been a coach and only a coach as a adult. He did actually work in private business briefly after graduation from DePaul University, DePaul W, not DePaul L. And he worked for Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical company, briefly. And then he couldn't resist the coaching. The bug bit him and he got into college coaching and we all know what happened there. Yeah, that's all I'm saying. Danny had coached with the Suns. And anyway, Danny was young. Yeah, exactly right. 40, same age, 44 when he got this job. And no one saw that coming either, John. That right. was a shock. He was out in Phoenix. He hadn't had a Boston connection since he had left the Celtics in 89 when he was traded to Sacramento. So that's a long period of time that he had no Boston connection, and suddenly he was back. And this was very stealth, stealthily done. The management then that hired him gave new clues that Danny Ainge was going to be their guy. So anyway, but all I'm saying is I just can't personally believe that Brad Stevens will never coach again. So I don't know how long he intends to do this job. Right now, of course, it's open-ended. He just started. And I think he has every opportunity to be good at it. He's a very bright guy. And he's had 8 years in the league experience, and he understands how this league works now. And he certainly knows what's on this particular team and who these guys are. Anyway, but that's the unanswered question. Brad, what are you going to be doing in 10 years, 15 years? I can't believe he's going to be sitting in an office.
Well, from the outside looking in, Mr. Ryan, you had to think that Stevens' job as coach was on the line this year. There was lots of talk and babble about, he has to do something this year to kind of earn another deal. And I don't know whether that's accurate or not, but that was sort of the consensus. To go from your job is on the line as head coach to another disappointing season, which you have acknowledged, and then to be essentially elevated to president of the club is a curious, curious scenario, one that I don't recall ever seeing before.
You are correct. I was going to ask you if you could cite anything in hockey. I know of nothing in baseball, basketball, or football.
That's I don't great. Know one.
Nope. Okay, here's something that I didn't take into immediate consideration that was pointed out to me, and it was, of course, Money. They owe him $30 million. And even if they were unhappy or decided that that him as a coach and that time to move on, they found a job for him that he is possibly qualified to do. And they owe him a lot of money. My initial reaction, I just didn't. So maybe that's the simple answer. they're going to pay him. They weren't going to pay him not to coach, but they'll pay him to run the team. I mean, I'm throwing it out there.
Yeah.
Well, will he under his title, or do you know, will he have control over personnel?
I believe he will, because I don't, these owners have not proven, they've not in any way been meddlesome. They certainly went with Danny. They gave Danny a full authority to do whatever he wanted. Obviously you couldn't, ultimately they have to sign the checks, but and sign off ultimately, but that's true in any organization. No, I think Danny had full autonomy, and I think that Brad will have, I would assume that Brad will have a similar autonomy.
Bob, what will Danny's legacy be as the Celtics president, Celtics general manager?
I hope that people will view it, that the majority, that the all the thinking people, and I think the thinking people will view it as a success. Yes, only one championship in 18 years. However, it's the only one in 35 years. He did produce one. Other than that, you got to go back to 1986. And so one in 35 years. And we, of course, look, I'm rationalizing. I was there and watching it happen. This is true. Many other teams and many other sports can launch a similar argument as the one I'm about to make. There was a window of 3 to 5 years. They achieved the goal in the first year, won 66 games after winning like 32 the year before. Okay. And it was a really good team. They were, I believe, the best team in 09. They won 62 games the second year. And then Kevin Garnett got hurt, was not available to play in the last two rounds. And they got beat by Orlando. They were better than Orlando with Garnett. I mean, no, any intelligent person knows that. They were the best team that year. They didn't win because of that injury. That was an untimely injury. The next year against the Lakers, they're up 3-2. They're going back to LA. Kendrick Perkins gets hurt in game 6. And all they needed from Rasheed Wallace, who had stayed out of shape the whole year, just being basically a clown, stealing money from them, was one game. Give us one game, for God's sake, Rasheed. and he couldn't do it. Even so, even then, give the Lakers credit. The Celtics were up by 3 points in the fourth quarter. And in three possessions, John and Bob, totaling 94 seconds on the clock, they went from plus three to minus six and never recovered. And the arc, the catalyst was a guy who had many big shots in that era for the Lakers. Derek Fisher comes down, walks right into a three and started the run. And the Lakers won that game. They could have, there was a 3 year window where they were arguably the best team. They got it done once. All right. So, and then there was a little resurgence now when we hired Brad and they got the three conference finals. And that should be considered to be a successful tenure, I think.
So there you go. Some of the best of the Bob McCown podcast from the past 12 months as we take a little vacation here. Much to the chagrin of the audience, I'm sure.
Well, not much of a vacation when you think of what's going on in the world, Bob. Still, but you know what? It's a good time to spend your family. Good time to have some quiet time. Enjoy some eggnog and some festive spirit.
Happy holidays to y'all from John and I. And we'll see you in the first week of January. Goodbye, everybody.